from LPM,
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
Welcome back to listeners. Doc, super excited for today's guest.
I am too.
An old friend of yours,
yes.
From way back in the day, who's making headlines all across the nation for his newest book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, and was on, NPR?
I think
Studio 1A, and it was just all the buzz. And so we're really excited amidst his book tour and book press that he made time to speak to us today. So please welcome to the show Professor Ibram X. Kendi. Dr. Kendi, how are you?
Hey, how are you?
Fantastic. Thank you for being with us. Kyla, I'll let you start. It's your old friends, huh?
Yes. Well, Ibram, it's so great to talk to you. And since we met in grad school and we finished Temple, you are the leading scholar about race, history, and discriminatory policy in America. You're also a professor at American University and the founding director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American. You are big time, and I am so elated and happy for you. And I'm so excited to talk to you about your latest book, because your other book, Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America, you won the National Book Award for Nonfiction for that in 2016. You are also a New York Times bestselling author. And your newest book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, explores, you know, not only some history of racist policy and discriminatory ideas, but also you talk a lot about your personal journey through unpacking and uncovering your own relationship to racism and other discriminatory thoughts. Tell our listeners a bit about what the crux of the book is about.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm really seeking to sort of capsize or eliminate this concept of not racist. And many Americans across really the ideological aisle, no matter what they say about race, no matter what policies they support, no matter what racial groups they lift up or look down upon, people typically self-identify as not racist. And I've found historically and even currently that there's really no meaning to that term other than really to deny typically one's own racism. But in fact, there is a such thing as being a racist or even being an anti-racist. And so for those Americans who imagine themselves as not racist, you know, I'm arguing that we should instead conceive of ourselves or be striving to be anti-racist, which means essentially not looking upon any racial group as better or worse than another, which means being a part of the movement that's challenging racist power and racist policies.
No, certainly. I mean, I love it. You want to throw out in your book, you talk about throwing out different conceptions like microaggressions, unconscious bias, and institutionalized racism, because you think not only are these things more abstract and confusing, but you're really, really seeking folks to become aware of racist policy that we've kind of turned a blind eye to that we don't even recognize. And you place yourself in your own ideological and personal journey at the center of this book. How hard or easy was it to place yourself at the center of this and make yourself part of your analysis, right? Because you talk, just like you mentioned just a moment ago, about how one group is no better or worse, and how Black folks themselves, yourself included, had started internalizing different racist ideas over time. Talk to our listeners a bit about unpacking your own internalized racism and exploring how Black folk can be misguided when it comes to what it means to be truly anti-racist.
Yeah, so it was extremely hard. Most people, I'm very private. But then even more so, I didn't want to relate to the world some of the most shameful moments and thoughts, you know, of my life. But at the same time, I realized, and I knew I was going to write about the fact that really the heartbeat of being an anti-racist is confession, is admitting, is acknowledging the ways in which we are trained to think that there's something wrong with with Black poor people, even as Black people, that we're trained to think that there's something wrong with Black women, even as Black people, that we're trained and nurtured to think that there's something wrong with queer Blacks, even as Black people. And so for me, I had to share in many ways how I came to think, or I should say internalize, those racist ideas. But even more so, I wanted to sort of share the experiences and even the people who were critical in really putting up a mirror to those ideas, which forced me to not like what I saw, which compelled me to sort of strive to be an anti-racist.
No, yes, yes. And you, and I was, I mean, I'm beyond flattered. I mean, you mentioned a lot of our cohort folk in the book.
Yeah, I was going to say, you mentioned, in fact, Dr. Story, and of course, Dr. Yabable, as folk who were your colleagues there at Temple. Talk a bit about, because I love that you do say on your website, but you hinted at that the only thing wrong with Black people is that we think something's wrong with other Black people. So talk a bit about that process, specifically meeting Dr. Story, Dr. Blay. Like, how easy or difficult was it? Were you resistant to that kind of new information in terms of meeting, or did it take you meeting individuals who were queer, who were Black women, who were Black poor folk to change your mind? Much more so than any kind of academic book could do or think piece could do. Does it sometimes take those personal relationships of knowing a Black person who we think we don't like to begin to change our minds?
Well, I do think it was clearly the personal relationships. I mean, you know, obviously, Kyla and Yaba, two of the most charismatic, you know, and amazing people, and people are really drawn to them. But then I also think it was the clarity of their ideas, and even the consistency of their ideas. And that I think was attractive for me. And so, you know, of course, when I arrived at Temple, I thought that I was sort of, to use today's terms, woke. You know, I thought that I was, you know, really down for Black people, when in fact they really showed me directly and indirectly through things that they said, but even more importantly, things that they modeled in terms of their critiques and even what they would sort of say, that I was really only down for Black heterosexual men. But I imagine that was Black people. And I think many people sort of standardized Black heterosexual men as being the Black community. And so it took me some time to really face up to that fact and to face up to the fact that if I'm serious about defending Black people, then I have to defend Black women. If I'm serious about defending Black people, I have to defend Black transgender women. I have to literally be a defender of all Black people.
Yeah. I love that. And I think that it always perplexes me as someone who was a leader in the Black Lives Matter movement here in Louisville and has, of course, been a national Black, you know, activist. It always confuses me when people have such a critique for the BLM movement, or, you know, which is primarily Black women and Black queer and trans led, and, you know, that somehow this kind of like gay agenda or a feminist agenda. and they just, it's so hard for some people to buy into the concept of all Black lives matter, right? That you can't be for Black people unless you're for all Black people. What words of advice would you give to somebody, professor, who isn't necessarily a scholar or college educated, might just be a regular activist, right? That's a straight Black dude that feels like has bought into the hype of some kind of queer agenda, some kind of feminist agenda that they see as antithetical to Black malehood, right? Because they bought into the hype of that a conspiracy to ruin the Black male, to emasculate the Black male. And they see almost the Black queer person, the Black trans person, the Black woman as the enemy to Black manhood, much like we see white folk, right? So what advice do you have for this, a lay person who's really struggling to grasp the notion of all Black lives, right? All of us or none of us. So what advice do you have for that kind of person?
I think it's important for us to understand the origins of those ideas. But even before that, for us to really understand that there's I talk about racist ideas as any idea that suggests a racial group is superior or inferior to another racial group in any way. And I say racial group as opposed to race because Black lesbians are a racial group. And Americans have specific ideas about Black lesbians that they do not have about white lesbians, that they do not have about Black heterosexual women or even white heterosexual women. And those ideas that Americans have about Black lesbians typically create this hierarchy in which Black lesbians are inferior to white lesbians, who are then inferior to Black heterosexual women, who are then inferior to white heterosexual women. And in order to truly be an anti-racist, it's not just sort of seeing Black men as equal to white men. It's seeing Black, I should say, white heterosexual women as equals to Black lesbians, and also seeing that the disparities between those two racial groups are not because there's something wrong with Black lesbians, as Black people, like other people, have been taught, that the disparities are in fact the result of this intersection of racist and homophobic policies. And so, for real, if you're not thereby challenging those racist policies that are intersecting with homophobic policies that are then leading to disparities between Black lesbian women and, excuse me, white heterosexual women, then you're essentially not challenging racism, which is probably essentially hanging you too. And so I don't think people recognize the ways in which they are essentially reinforcing ideas and policies that are harming them when they're not sharply defending Black queer people.
No, I mean, certainly. I just adore you, Ibram. You mentioned in the book that racism, right, which is this really large misconception, that racism is not the product of hatred or ignorance. Rather, it is something that comes and is birthed out of raw self-interest. Unpack that for our listeners. What does that mean? Because oftentimes, when we do talk about white supremacy and racism and even ideas about anti-racism, we talk about it coming from this really emotionally fueled place as opposed to genuine self-interest over, you know, discriminatory behavior. So why does racism, how is that not the product of hatred and ignorance?
So I think probably one of the most obvious examples is during the enslavement era, in which you had slaveholders and their defenders making a case that we're enslaving Black people because we're doing God's duty, because they're the cursed descendants of Ham. Or we're enslaving Black people because they are barbaric and we hate them, and we need to keep them chained so they don't ravage free white society. Or we're enslaving Black people because we're actually civilizing them, you know, after, you know, thousands of years within wild Africa. So actually, that is why we're enslaving Black people. That was the reason that these slaveholders gave. But what was actually the reason was that they were slaveholding Black people to make money. Mm-hmm. And to become the richest by 1860 group of people in the world, as wealthy white slaveholders were in the South. But what happened was people were constantly challenging their slaveholding policies, questioning their slaveholding policies. And so they were not going to say, we are simply enslaving these people and terrorizing these people and torturing these people to make money. We're doing it for this reason. And that reason essentially connoted racist ideas. And so therefore the racist ideas came to justify the policies. And then you had Americans who didn't know any better in the North or far removed from plantations, consuming those racist ideas that Black people are the cursed descendants of Ham, or that they're being civilized in slavery. And then that actually caused them to become ignorant about slavery. So actually the racist ideas were leading to the ignorance, and even in some cases, the hate. Those people who believed that Black people were these ravaging animals that if unleashed on society would ravage white America. And so, yeah, I hate those animals because of everything that they've done when they resisted slavery or engaged in those slave revolts. And so people came to hate them too, but that hate was coming out of racist ideas, and those racist ideas were essentially justifying racist policies, and the racist policies were initiated because people wanted to make money, i.e. self-interest.
Exactly. I mean, I just love, and it's the way that you thread law and all sorts of different bodies of knowledge together to make that astute point, and I think it's a point that a lot of folks, practitioners who are trying to teach about anti-racism and white supremacy, they just miss. So I just really, really appreciate that, you know, central aspect of your book. Toward the end of the book, you talk about your battle with colon cancer. You also mention your wife's battle with cancer and your mother's previous battle with cancer. And you connect this to racism, right? Talk to our listeners a bit about that journey. I mean, it's incomprehensible to me that you are writing this book while you're battling cancer. That's one. Two, how do you use you surviving colon cancer and that journey and connect that metaphorically to racism in America?
Well, I think first and foremost, it is very, very, you have many Americans who say, don't classify that person as racist because that's going to hurt their feelings. They're going to shut down, which is equivalent to saying to a person, don't tell that person that they have cancer because that's going to hurt their feelings and they're going to shut down and they're going to be upset at you. But we don't have that perception when it comes to serious diseases. When it comes to something like cancer, collectively and commonly, as a society, we think people should know, even if it's going to hurt them. And so I think that's the sort of first connection that, you know, we should be understanding someone who is infected or a nation that's infected by racism as equivalent to somebody who was diagnosed or who has cancer. In other words, they need to know despite how they're going to feel about it. And then, you know, once we let them know, we have some people who we tell them and they just want to deny it. They don't want to believe that they have cancer because they don't want to go through the process of treatment, which is extremely painful. So then what happens to the cancer? It spreads. It gets worse. The likelihood of them dying grows. And so it's critical for us to admit that we have racism so we can save ourselves. And then finally, when we go about treating racism, we can treat it in the same way we treat cancer, which is cancers, particularly metastatic cancers like mine, there's a local and a systemic treatment. And so the local treatment is you go in and surgically remove the racist policies from the body politic. But then you also have a systemic treatment, which is you flood the body with anti-racist policies, which have the capacity to reduce racial inequity in the way chemotherapy is supposed to shrink the size of tumors. But then that chemotherapy is also supposed to prevent a reoccurrence of cancer cells in the way anti-racist policies can prevent a reoccurrence from, you know, of racial inequity. But then we don't stop there. Then the next thing is to follow the body very closely to make sure there's not a reoccurrence. We can do that. We can treat racism in the way we treat cancer.
Mm, yeah.
I love it. I tell you what, Professor, I really appreciate your book and the way in which you've approached your book by using personal narratives. And I love that you say that, you know, it's not enough to be not racist if one considers themselves that, but to be anti-racist, and that you define that as actively supporting an anti-racist policy or espousing anti-racist ideology. And I just think about these political times, especially with white women or even like apolitical black folks who kind of feel like, well, I don't hate, you know, insert Mexicans, gays, etc., but never found themselves actively supporting policies that uplift those people. So we think about, you know, voter disenfranchisement. We think about restoration of voter rights for felons. We think about criminal justice reform or immigration issues. And then this is perhaps a call to action for those people who think that they're not bigots, who think they're not racist or homophobic or any other things, to actively support a political issue that begins to change the tide. So I really appreciate your inserting your personal narrative in that to show us that there's a journey we can all take. But I do want to ask you, before we let you go, Professor, I mean, you've had a wonderful book tour. You've gotten all kind of book awards, been on TV shows, radio shows. And what, though, has been, are you taking time to enjoy this? In other words, like, what's been the most exciting part? Has it been the world travel? Has it been seeing your name in lights? Has it been, you know, a bump in income? Like, what's been the parts that you've really enjoyed about kind of your notoriety and your acclaim outside of just the, you know, the value you're adding academically? But what's been like the parts that you like, I really enjoy this shit?
I mean, it was really rewarding, particularly when some of the people who I showcased in the book, like Kyla and Yava and others, were actually sort of happy or proud of the book itself, or sort of how they were portrayed, and just sort of how important they were in my own sort of journey. But then even also, you know, seeing people be transformed, or seeing people being willing to confess and admit the ways in which they actually do think there's something wrong with Latinx people or Black people or, you know, or Black gay people. And that admission and them reflecting and announcing it on social media, or even I've seen publicly in forums, I think has been the most rewarding, because it was extremely hard for me to do that. And certainly in those times, but then even to do that publicly through this book. And so I know how hard that is to do. And so when people do it, that's really rewarding for me.
I love it. Listeners, our guest today has been Dr. Ibram X. Kendi. The book is called How to Be an Anti-Racist. It's on Random House Penguin. Check it out. Professor, thank you so much for making time. And Doc, I'll give you the last word.
Yes. No, Ibram, thank you so much. And I just wanted to say thank you so much again. I mean, when I was reading your book, I was crying. I was very humbled and honored to be a part of it. And I really had no idea that my abrasive, strange personality made such an impact on you. And it just felt so good to read that it did, and to know that. And so thank you so much for that. And I'm just so, so happy and excited for you and proud of you. And I live. So thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, I live too. And yeah, of course, the gratitude is all mine.
Bye-bye. Please take care. All right, Doc, let's take a quick break. Tell the people who we be.
You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast. The work we do on Strange Fruit wouldn't be possible without your support. If we've made you laugh,
or made you think,
we hope you'll consider chipping in.
Visit donate.strangefruitpod.org.
That's donate@strangefruitpod.org. Thank you. Welcome back. You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Doc, question for you. Have you ever... Well, first of all, you know how to ride a bicycle, yes?
I know how to ride a bicycle, yes.
Okay, good. Around when did you learn? Like, around what age?
I think I learned because I had a banana seat bike, and it was a Schwinn, and it was pink.
Oh, fancy.
And so, yes, I think I was like maybe 9, 10, something like that.
Have you ever ridden a moped?
I've never ridden a moped.
Okay, what about a dirt bike?
Never a dirt bike.
What about a motorcycle?
I've never ridden a motorcycle, but my my wife, Missy, yes, was in a motorcycle club.
Oh, my goodness.
And she owned a motorcycle.
Well, on that topic, was it a black women's?
It was a black women's club. Her motorcycle club was called Fantasy Queens.
They were out of Lexington or Louisville?
In Lexington.
Lexington, Kentucky. Uh-huh. Well, listen, that's so perfect for today's conversation and today's guest. It's all about black women and their motorcycle clubs. And so I was really delighted to see a piece on Zora called, Yes, Black Girls Ride Too. It's all about how women of color are part of motorsports culture. So please welcome to the show, writer of that particular piece, Jonita Davis, to the show. Hi, Jonita.
Hi, hello.
How's it going?
It's going great. It's going great.
Good. Now, I myself have never ridden a motorcycle, nor is Kyla, but and I'll tell you what, it looks thrilling. It looks sexy.
It does look sexy.
It looks really bossy, no matter what genders do it. But I love that your piece in particular, I guess Missy can relate, your wife Missy can relate, mm-hmm, but your piece in particular talks about black women and the proliferation of motorcycle clubs for black women. Now, we open your story meeting a particular person, and she's giving some instructions to black women, mm-hmm, on how to get someplace. So just tell us, set the story for us. Who do we meet at the beginning of your story, and what instructions is she giving, and where are folk heading to?
Okay, so first of all, I need to say, I don't write either.
Okay, cool, good. I'm a good company.
No. I'm just a writer who was given some information. I'm like, why aren't people talking about this? So that's why I pursued the story. So when we opened the article, it is Portia Taylor, the founder of Black Girls Ride, the publication and the group on Facebook, and I think they're on all social media platforms now. And they're going to Essence Fest this year.
And they're going to ride their bikes all the way to Essence.
All the way from LA.
And from so, LA. By the way, wow.
For people who don't know, listeners, white folk who listen to the show, it's this big festival. It's in New Orleans. If you've seen the movie Girls Trip, you know that that's like, so it's, and, you know, for black folk, it's like the place to be. It's like, I guess, maybe even the new Freaknik, if you will, or the modern day Freaknik. But it's a wonderful cultural festival with arts and music, entertainment, and education. So it's a pretty big deal. And so these women, Jonita, are heading from, they're going to ride their bikes from L.A., a lot of them, to New Orleans. Well, goodness, so what kind of instructions is Portia telling folk to make this long-ass trip?
So Portia is, and this is the thing about women taking, you know, kind of making black women making their mark. She's telling them to care for yourself. It's going to be hot. You know, it's going to be long. It's going to be, you know, the heat. I think she called the heat disrespectful. She's like, so you need to dress for this. You need to have your water. You need to have your skin covered. You know, you need to dress for the ride and the slide, you know, her phrase, which means having your arms covered, your skin covered, just in case something happens and you hit that pavement. You need to have your gear. You need to have, you know, you need to make sure that you are prepared to not only endure the miles, but the heat and the sun, because they were riding through a desert portion at one point, and the sun was just coming down at 100. It was like 108 degrees. You need to be prepared for that. So she's trying to make sure everybody, you know, and making sure that they know that we're going to be riding long hours, stopping at night, you know, but, you know, everybody needs to be, you know, make sure we are healthy and we are safe and we are, you know, everybody's well cared for. So.
And Taylor's group is going to be joined by black women riders all across the country.
All across the country. Yeah. Coming up as they go along. It ended up being like over 225 riders, I think.
Yes, in your piece you say it's going to be 225 riders, and you talk about that the ride, as much as it's about bonding and stuff like that, it also turns into a party and an example of solidarity and sisterhood. Talk a little bit about, to our listeners, about how these black women motorcycle clubs and groups kind of come together and share and talk and express sisterhood with one another.
Well, I mean, first of all, a lot of them call their bikes therapy. They named the bike therapy.
Yes.
So, you know, that kind of gives you an idea of how they see writing. I mean, writing is something that is apart from motherhood, is apart from my professional whatever title I have. It's a place where I can come and relax and let my hair down and be me with a lot of other women with the same, you know, interest. And so they end up, you know, the laughter, the music, the, you know, just being black women unapologetic and without having to censor yourself, you know, the way we have to in certain spaces, because it's just black girls together doing their thing. So it's really, really unique. It's a really, really safe space because some of the spaces with the men in them are not really all that, you know, there's some, you know, danger involved. Sometimes we get a bunch of men bikers together and there's not very few women. There's safety, you know, issues. But with just the women, it's just, you know, just all about just being your unapologetic self. And yeah, the music, the you know, the talking, the food, the, you know, and they just have a good old time just going across the country. I actually felt really, really terrible that I couldn't make it with them because Portia made it sound so fun. And I'm like, I want to go next year.
I mean, it sounds like an absolute ball. Now, Taylor's magazine, Black Girls Ride, when she initially started, it's a magazine. It's a national publication. It includes interviews, safety information, ads, so on and so forth. And in your piece, you say she wanted to create this part and parcel because she wanted a publication that was out there that was a national magazine geared toward black women without this idea of the male gaze, or I would assume male riders and that gaze. And you mentioned it just briefly in your answer, talking about how sometimes when there are few black women riders and there's a lot of black male motorcycle riders, talk a little bit about what kind of danger happens when black women are outnumbered in motorcycle clubs, and also how important it was for Taylor to create this magazine absent of the male gaze.
Well, when we talked, she really didn't dwell on just, you know, those negative effects. She wanted to keep it positive, but we know the statistics. We know how it is when, you know, you get a few women in with certain numbers of these clubs, and we know how the statistics on some of these clubs, they're really dangerous. Some of them have a criminal element, and you know, and they're largely men. And so you get a few women, especially Black women, in there. It's not really safe. It's not really somewhere where you can kind of let your hair down because you got to be on guard all the time. But again, you know, Portia didn't want to really dwell on that. She wanted to kind of keep it positive by saying that, you know, it's all about, you know, having a safer space for the women. Yeah.
One of my favorite things about, you mentioned the camaraderie, the sisterhood. One of my favorite things is when new women riders join the club, right, Doc?
Mm-hmm, I love that.
They throw them like a biker shower.
Yeah.
So, you know, and you mentioned that it can be really expensive for anybody, period, to buy a bike, let alone all the gear, lessons, but especially women, because women obviously make less than men. Women sometimes have household expenses, childcare, other needs. So when these women discover biking, save their money, finally buy their first bike, the women around them will throw them a biker party where they will give them some of their first gear. They may pass them some little life lessons, or this is the first pair of gloves I ever bought, and I love these gloves, or this is some sunscreen that worked particularly well for me. And so they really do kind of lift one another up and become a bit of a social club, but also understanding the importance of passing down the knowledge. And so it isn't just about like, yo, let's ride together.
Right.
But let's be some kind of street gang. It really does become about let's pass on tidbits of information. But beyond Black Girls Ride, are there any other publications right now, or even for that matter, even like national organizations that represent Black women? Like what do Black women, how are they represented right now in popular motorsports, education, and media? Or is there kind of an absence?
There are Black women, there are motorcycle clubs with Black women all across the country.
Certainly,
but
yeah.
There's still, I still did not find a publication that is like Black Girls Ride, that's national, that covers, you know, Black women and women in general. I really didn't find anything. There is nothing really out there. I mean, there are some blogs started by Black women who are, you know, kind of getting their voice, but they come up after Portia Taylor did. So, you know, she kind of started that. I think that Black Girls Ride is what there is what there is, and you know, which makes it even a greater resource, I think. And back to the biker showers, that's one of the things that she wanted to kind of that Taylor wanted to kind of hone in on, is because she told me that women traditionally, when they learn to ride, they learn to ride from the men in the family, and the men in the family are passing down bad habits that they don't want to admit are bad habits. And some of them don't even know the right way and don't, you know, and they don't want to admit it. So they're passing on to this woman how to ride this bike and not giving her the tools and tips that she needs for her, you know, to be able to be safe and successful. And that's another reason for the biker shower, is to kind of make sure that, you know, these women know, you know, they're given the right tools, the right safety information, the right, you know, making sure that they're trained the right way, which and in that same vein, Black Girls Ride also does, like, there's training workshops, and, you know, there's scholarships through Polaris sponsorship that they actually give to women too, to learn how to ride.
I love that.
Yeah. I love that. I love that too. So talk to a bit because these clubs, right, and these groups and these riders have the solidarity, they have the sisterhood. It's also, and calling their bikes, for instance, therapy. It's not just like therapy, but you talk a bit about in your piece that it also feels empowering. It also makes them feel a sense of empowerment. Talk to us a bit about how riding and riding across country the way that Taylor's group and others' groups can be empowering for Black women.
Well, I actually, when the ones I talk to, they all said the same thing. You know, it's just kind of being in charge of yourself. It's just you and the bike and the road. And, you know, you don't have any other responsibilities. And, you know, it's just you. And then, you know, when you do one of these long distance rides, I did that. I accomplished that on my own, you know, maybe with, you know, some of my sisters with me. But I did that without having, you know, whoever looking over my shoulder. I did that. Maybe it's a first time accomplishment. You get a mom who's like always had her kids hanging on her, you know, loves to death, but, you know, they're always there. And, you know, this is the first thing she's accomplished by herself, for herself. You know, that's empowering. And I have to say, I actually went on a junket with Polaris and actually rode one of the their slingshots, and that is hella empowering when you get in one of those
things. Is a slingshot the little chair on the side of the bike?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, we were on the coast of Oregon, and it's just, you know, the road, the ocean, and a cliff, you know, and you know, you got the forest, and it's just, I mean, just you and nature, and it makes you feel like you can do anything, you know? It's like, why am I keeping myself in a box? I can do this.
Yeah.
You know, let's take on the world. So that feeling... is that you get from just, you know, being on the motorcycle, on the road, is really powerful. And it's just you and this machine that's roaring, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, that whole experience, I know myself, I felt it. So it really makes you kind of put things in the new perspective. And so I can see why they call it therapy. I can see why women are, you know, they just really look forward to this Essence ride. For some of them, that's the ride, their ride of the year. There are other rides they take during the year. One of them goes all the way to Mexico and back. And so I mean, I see why women, you know, they want to do this, why Black women are a growing number of motorcyclists, you know, getting into it, because it's really something that kind of changes your mindset when it comes to, you know, what we're capable of, what we can do in this world. So.
Yeah, no, I mean, I really loved it. Toward the end of your piece, you talk, you put a little bit of history in there about one of the first publications around motorcycle riding, and it was Rider Magazine in 1903, but this was during a time where Black women had all of no voice, Black men had hardly any, they were seen as objects and defined outside of themselves. But you mentioned 30 years after this publication was birthed, Bessie Stringfield cut a trail through Jim Crow South on her motorcycle, right, which defied races. Tell us a little bit about Bessie and how revolutionary her making this motorcycle path was.
Well, when you look up, and I'm not an expert on this, so forgive me if anybody out there, you know, hears me say something in there, but Bessie Stringfield, from what I saw, she was a superhero. I mean, yeah, Wonder Woman ain't got nothing on her.
Okay.
She basically just, you know, just went out and was like, I'm just going to do this. Motorcycling is for more than just, you know, white men and even Black men who, you know, the few Black men who were doing it. And she just kind of jumped on her bike and, you know, became this symbol of just kind of empowerment then. And, you know, defiance even in her ride. Just, you know, just the fact that she was a Black woman who was on this motorcycle, who was riding by herself.
That itself was groundbreaking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
And she's empowered people since then.
Yeah, I'm sitting here reading a bit about her. It says, I'm reading that it says that she actually was the first Black woman to ride a motorcycle in every one of the 48 connected states. And she did this in 1930. Mm-hmm. So let's think about what's happening sociopolitically for Black people in 1930.
Yeah.
Right. And like, she is just like a Black woman solo dolo riding through every state, especially the South. I love it. I learned some really cool stuff on Janita in your piece. And that is that women account for at least 20% of motorsport, like merchandising, right? That it's women folk who are buying at least 20%, which I think is a pretty significant market of any kind. I mean, you think about biking, you think about mechanics. I mean, at least I'm thinking about, like, Tim the Toolman Taylor, like, super macho type stuff. But women are doing, and even beyond that, I think you said that 53% of Black bike owners are women.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Are women. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love it.
Women
I love it.
Overtaking that, Black men.
It's counter-narrative, I think, to popular ideology around motorcycle clubs. I mean, I know that Louisville had its own share biker clubs, MCs, but we usually think about the Black men and that narrative is dominated, I think, either movies or television, that it's simply a man's sport. But clearly Black women, as you say, are riding to, and they're doing it, they're making it more than just a motorcycle club, right? It's becoming a support system, a therapy group. It's about education, it's about support. And I just really appreciate you writing this piece and sharing with us and our listeners, number one, the rich history of Black women bikers, but then also understanding what's happening right now. And I'm sure there's somebody out there, Doc, maybe even yourself, that's going to go out and buy a bicycle, you know, buy you a bike.
Yes.
And maybe next year, I can ride a shotgun with you. I can ride a yoke slingshot.
I can never, I'm like, one, I'm scared of the highway in a car, right? Okay, and motorcycle. And plus, motorcycles, that was the fascinating thing and also the sexy thing to me about a motorcycle is that they can outrun most cars. I mean, they get up.
They do get fast. If you all see the pictures, Angelina's piece, y'all, there's lots of wonderful photography, Doc, but you can get you one of the, well, this is right up my alley, one of the three-wheel motorcycles, you know?
But that's not...
Yes, it counts. It counts.
So
it's much more stable, which is what I need, right? So then you get the little... Dukes of Hazzard, where someone drove a motorcycle, that was like the little slingshot on the side, and I can like ride shotgun with you.
Well, Missy has been talking, at least for the past 2 years, like, I should get a bike again, I should get a bike, I can afford a bike, I'll get a bike. And she's like, you will ride with me? And I'm like, no.
No, no. We're just way too fragile.
Yeah.
But listen, Angelina, thank you so much for writing this piece. Let our listeners know who want to follow more of your work and your writing. How can people find you online and keep up with your brilliant writing?
Well, I'm all over social media all the time. Just look for Jonita, J-O-N-I-T-A-L Davis. That's my handle on all the platforms. And my writing is on my blog at jonitadavis.com. So you can follow me and find me there, and that'll lead you to my Medium works and everything else. So.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us, and please take care.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Doc, let's take a quick break. Tell the people who we are.
You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Welcome back. You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
All right. Thanks so much to today's guest. So, Doc, it's still November, which means it is still Inspirational Role Models Month. And so I wanted to give you the microphone today to talk about the folks in your life who have been inspirational role models for you. So who you got?
Oh, so I have three. So my first role models are my parents, both my mom and my dad. They're my first teachers, my first best friends. They've taught me so much. They still teach me to this day. They are incredibly smart and kind and empathetic. And they've really made me the person that I am in terms of the subject matter that I teach, how I teach, you know, how I am in the world, right? And so I give kudos to them for raising me. Oh, okay, their names. Dr. Ralph Story and Sylvia Rogers. Those are my parents, and I adore them.
I love you. You know I adore them, too. Yes, of course.
Yes, they're a hoot at the same time. That they're like good teachers and stuff like that. My other two people, so I met when I was an undergrad at DePaul University in Chicago. And so this is my first academic mentor, Dr. Ann Russo, who still is at DePaul University, shaping minds and changing lives. And Ann introduced me to Black feminist theory and activism and taught me that the Black feminist tradition went back way longer than I had anticipated or knew. And I was so inspired by her. She was so patient with me. I was constantly bombarding her and getting in her office, you know, during office hours, asking her all types of questions. I mean, it was the first time in my life where I knew about feminist theory and specifically Black feminist theory and then Black lesbian feminist theory. And so I'm continuously grateful for her patience and kindness, and I think, you know, just how gracious she was with me, how angry I was, how mad I was at so many things. It was like the first time I'm coming in any kind of consciousness around gender and sexuality and racism. So, you know, she just was always so gracious with me. And my other mentor there was Dr. Francesca Royster, who is still at DePaul University, teaching and shaping minds and changing lives. And so Francesca actually taught the first class I took. I took independent studies with Anne on Black feminist theory, but the first class that I took was her Black feminisms class at DePaul University. And you know that I teach a Black feminisms class, and that class was inspired by her and her teaching. It was the first class that I read another mentor. Oh, my God, I have so many. Another mentor, which is Joan Morgan, When Chicken Heads Come Home to Roost. And you know that for years I've used Joan's book in my Black feminist class. as a way to introduce the praxis of Black feminist theory. And so that was the first time I was introduced to her work when I was like 19. And so I'm just, all of the mentors in my life who have been patient and kind and gracious and giving with their knowledge and with me, I'm just so grateful. So my parents, Dr. Ann Russo, Dr. Francesca Royster, and Joe Morgan.
I love it. I love it. I love it. What a great list.
Yes.
All folks I really love as well. So let's hop into some juicy fruit before we go.
Okay.
So there is a case. This is a really absurd case. This case is out of New York City. And there's actually an employee who is suing his former employer, saying that his pay was slashed in half because he was gay. And the rationale being that he should make the same amount of money as the females in the office, quote unquote. So listen, the story is of one Wesley Wernicke. He was an employee of a high-profile event company in New York City. They put on events for companies like Nike and other really high-profile kind of companies like Twitter and Amazon. And so Wernicke says he was a senior producer for this company and that, you know, things were going really well on the job. He loved the job. They loved him. But then one day his coworker commented on his engagement ring, that I guess his engagement ring was too small or too demure. And they said that his ring was girly and said, hey, well, does your wife wear a similar engagement ring that's so small and girly? And so he says, actually, my partner is a dude and his name is Evan. And yes, he wears a ring similar to mine. And so Wesley says that once he came out as gay, his boss and his coworkers began to exclude him from professional meetings and social events, that he was passed over for assignments with large commissions, and that he was subject to discriminatory remarks. He says that every week they would have, on Fridays, a big welcome party to the office, and the boss would give people fist bumps and a greeting of Shabbat Shalom, but that from now on, the boss would walk past his desk without speaking, that every so often they would have, quote-unquote, drinks with the fellas, but he got uninvited from those things, and then eventually, these things took a toll on his mental health, that he had to see a psychiatrist, and take antidepressants, that he was really being kind of punished and ostracized from the office, from the guys, because he was gay. Then eventually, he said the final straw came when his boss comes into the office and says, hey, I'm going to cut your salary from $145,000 a year to $70,000 a year.
And so God.
He's like, why are you going to cut my salary in half? I mean, we agreed upon $145,000. And he says, the boss says, quote, I couldn't sleep at night thinking that you were being paid so much more than the other females in the office. So he alleges that his boss tells him that because you're gay, you're essentially a female, quote unquote, or woman, and you should be making the same amount of money as the other women. So he said that his salary was first cut to $70,000 and then eventually cut even further to $58,000, which is significantly less than his original $145,000. So he said eventually they just fired him, and so now he's suing them. What do you make of this story, Doc?
Oh, my God. Okay, first of all, what state is this in?
This is in New York. This is New York City.
So this is in New York. This is New York City, child.
Yeah, New York City.
Is this some kind of... So this isn't a national corporation. This is like some kind of private company
it's a company called Eventique. E-V-E-N-T-I-Q-E. So, like, you know, it throws events for, like, high-profile clients. You know, like, puts on... you know, festivals or conventions for entertainment type clients.
And so the boss and upper, you know, bosses weren't interviewed for the story. It was just...
I mean, yeah, this is, of course, according to MetroWeekly.com. This is just, you know, most lawsuits are one-sided. This, of course, is according to his lawyers. I mean, they haven't responded publicly or said if it's true or not true. But this, well, of course, the boss's lawyer... denying the allegations, called them baseless. But again, this is just a really brief story I read about his version of this lawsuit. So this is what he's alleging. He's alleging that they said, you're gay, you're a woman, you don't get no money. But of course, there's certainly probably another side to the story. But, I mean, so I guess you asked that because this story seems too hyperbole to believe?
I just feel like there's just several things going on that are a huge problem. One, the fact that the pay equity for the men and the women in the office is at such a disparity. So the fact that at one point in time he's making $145,000 to then be dropped to $70,000. So does that mean that the women, so that's my first question, the women in the company who are doing the same job are technically making that much less than male execs? Two,
according to this guy, yes.
Yeah, so that's a huge issue. That's a huge issue. And then two, the fact that the boss is somehow conflating his queerness with also a gender change, when sexuality and gender aren't things that should be tethered together or go together. So that's also a problem. And then my other problem is three, that when this employee was made aware of the fact that his salary was going to be reduced by such a considerable amount, why was he not also outraged that the women in the company make a considerable amount less than he was making? Right.
You,
so,
you,
I mean,
child, you know what that is, you know, because, you know, gay man child can be just as sexist as straight man.
Yes.
And
yeah,
he only cares when, again, like they say, yes, that just like they say that homophobia is straight men's fear that gay men would treat them the way they treat women. He's only upset because he's being treated like a woman. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
but not upset that women are being treated the way they are in the company. Exactly. So those are my things. I mean, I think that he needs to be able to get his money back, but I also think that this company needs to make a better effort to, one, get rid of their homophobia. I don't know if that means trainings or seminars or, you know, attending speaking engagements, so on and so forth. And they also need to kind of undo this sexist thinking around making the women in the company make a considerable amount less than the men. So I don't know if that means training, seminars, so on and so forth. But I hope he wins his case. And I also hope that a part of the outcome of the winning of the case has to do with some equity all around, all across the board, right? Get his money back, but then also what is going on with the salaries of the women in this company, child? I'm just like, no.
Well, let's go from one absurd story to one even more absurd, Doc. So, of course, okay, the new Harriet movie came out recently, and you loved it, by the way, right?
Oh, my God. You know, I went on and on. I talked to you about a good 30 minutes about how much I loved
it.
I want to go see it again.
Yes, you
want to. I could see it two or three times again. It was so well done.
I love it. So, well, here's some funny news, Doc. So, apparently that movie was pitched almost 25 years ago. And so the screenwriter for the movie, his name is Gregory Allen Howard, recently told the media, this is reported, of course, by Variety.com, he told the media that 25 years ago, when this movie was first pitched, there was a particular Hollywood actress that one Hollywood executive wanted to play the role of Harriet Tubman. Who would you guess that was? 25 years ago, they were America's Sweetheart.
Oh, my God, America's Sweetheart. Are you talking about Julia Roberts?
Julia Roberts. That is right, Doc. Yes. So listen. 25 years ago, this studio executive heard the pitch, and he says that he wants Julia Roberts to play Harriet Tubman. Now, fortunately, there was one black person in that room who told the boss, sir, Harriet Tubman was a black woman. And the president replied, allegedly, quote, that was so long ago, no one would know that. To say that Harriet Tubman existed so long ago, that to tell the story portrayed by a white woman, that I guess that was just semantics. That no one.
So I assume they were going to put Roberts in blackface.
No, I think they were going to have Julia Roberts as a
Stop
white
it.
Woman.
Stop it right now.
That blackface, Doc, they're going to have Julia Roberts as a white woman play the role of a person who helps enslaved people escape enslavement. And so the person argued, you know, like she was some kind of John Brown.
Shut up.
The executive said that it was so long ago that it didn't really matter that Harriet Tubman was black in real life, that no one really knew, no one really would know that, but that we can still tell the story with Julia Roberts playing the role of Harriet Tubman.
So what did the filmmaker even say in response to the studio execs? Like, yeah, that's
what's up?
I think he didn't
say what his response was. He just says, like, luckily that didn't really go anywhere. And, yeah. so lucky for us. But this very well. And again, that's not to say that Julia Roberts will take the role. That's not to say there wouldn't be someone else down the line who says, nigga, you crazy. That is to say that there was one person and luckily, I would say luckily, Doc, because we often see commercials or TV shows or movies where we're like, yo, where was the black people in the room? And why did nobody stop you before you did this? So luckily we have the case now of somebody black in the room said, no, let's not. And so I'm really appreciative of whoever that person was 25 years ago.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. So anyway.
Thank you so much, because that is like, I can't even fathom.
I know.
I mean, even if I think about 25 years ago, I mean, thinking about folks like Whoopi Goldberg with, and you know, because she had, by that point had just finished Color Purple, or if Color Purple was still like in the memories of moviegoers. I mean, anybody from the cast of Color Purple could have played Harriet Tubman back in the day. I mean, there was just, we don't have that much visibility of Black actors and actresses back in the day like that. So Hollywood has come a long way in that respect. But I just can't believe that that was a actual and real conversation. But then again, I can believe. And then again, I'm like still disgusted. So it's like, oh my God, I mean, so Julia Roberts, though, because it's going to change my opinion about her. So
well, no,
Julia
that's, Roberts didn't that's, know that's, this. That's this not just a conversation. Listen, that's not to say that she was even involved in the conversations.
Okay.
So, what
are the
negotiations? Okay. This was like during a pitch meeting. And I think that someone just kind of said that, the executive was saying in passing, or kind of saying, you know, like you pitch a project and someone's like, yeah, we can do that. You know, and I guess the executive said, yeah, Julia Roberts. They were like, yeah, no. So that's not to say that she was any parts of privy to any of this. That's just saying that the executive threw her name out there, and that could have been a possibility in some distant kind of universe. I don't know. But
okay, got you.
So anyway, listeners,
oh my God.
I know. Well, did you have a good show? Did you have a good show today?
Yes, I had so much fun, and it was so great to get to talk to you.
Oh, as always, I love you so much. And we're out of time, though, for this week, so let's do it again next week. Say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody. Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media. Our engineer is Koja Toshiro, who also composed our theme music. For more information about Strange Fruit, visit strangefruitpod.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod.
The views expressed on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters. Strange Fruit is produced by me, Kyla Story.
And me, Jason Gardner.
Thanks for listening.